The Beginning of the Gospel, Commentary for the July 6, 2024 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. My fellow prisoner Aristarchus sends you his greetings, as does Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. You have received instructions about him. If he comes to you, welcome him. Colossians 4, verse 10. John Mark the Evangelist is an enigmatic figure. While not central to any book of the New Testament, he is mentioned in several of them, sometimes as John, sometimes as Mark, and also as John Mark. Nonetheless, the Gospel according to Mark is foundational to the Synoptic Gospels, appearing to have been written first, with Matthew and Luke drawing upon and expanding Mark's narrative in their Gospels. It is interesting that Acts, written by Luke, is the only record of the dispute between Paul and Barnabas over Mark's effectiveness as an evangelist. Some have interpreted this as an effort to diminish Mark's Gospel in importance compared to Luke's more exhaustive two-volume work. Since there was bickering among the 12 disciples, when Jesus walked with them, such competition could be expected to continue even after Jesus ascended to heaven. Luke's account does not say much about the falling out between Paul and Barnabas, only that Mark returned to Jerusalem, leaving them to work in Pamphylia without his assistance. As a result, there has been much speculation. His mother Mary owned a large house in Jerusalem, so his upbringing may have been one of privilege and not privation. Lucille Knapp, instructor for the first 2 years of New Testament Greek for all theology majors during the time I attended Walla Walla College, liked to point out that Mark was a city boy. She based this on his account of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. Mark is the only writer to describe the site of the temptation as being where the wild beasts are. She also felt that in chapter 14 of his gospel, where he mentioned a young man following Jesus, who when Jesus was arrested, fled naked, leaving his garment behind, this was Mark referring to himself, since no other gospel mentions this incident. All of this, while not proof, is evidence of a young man with a tendency to flee confrontation and hardship, very much the opposite of Paul's headstrong, direct method of confronting his critics. Such a person might well see Mark's timidity in a negative light. Mark might have seen Paul's temerity as provoking conflict. Unable to overcome Paul's expectations, a person such as Mark would often flee the conflict, and a strong-willed person like Paul would refuse, at least initially, to allow that he was in any way responsible for the falling out. When later Mark sought to rejoin their missionary journeys, Paul would not allow it, pairing instead with Silas. Mark then joined with his cousin Barnabas, who stood up on his behalf, on a separate missionary trip. As is often the case with strong-willed individuals, when the heat of the moment was past and Mark had proven his worth despite the earlier confrontation, reconciliation appears to have taken place, as he has mentioned several times as being in the company with Paul in the epistles. Without citing any sources, Fox's Book of Martyrs claims that Mark served as Peter's amanuensis, writing his gospel based on Peter's dictation. Peter in his first epistle refers to Mark as his son, which may be taken by some as an indirect support of this idea. Fox tells us that Mark was martyred by being drugged through the streets of Alexandria, Egypt, until near death, tossed into prison where he died of his wounds, and then his body was burned. His bones were collected by his followers and eventually found their way to Venice. He became the patron saint of that city, and the citizens erected a large basilica in his honor. Mark opens his gospel with John the Baptist as the messenger promised in Isaiah 40, verse 3, a voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. This is a fulfillment of the prophetic chronology of Daniel regarding the coming Messiah. 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. No one understand this. From the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble, after the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be put to death and will have nothing. Daniel 9, verses 24 through 26. Artaxerxes gave the command to rebuild Jerusalem in 457 BCE. If we view the sevens in Daniel as weeks, that gives us a total of 69 weeks from that commandment to the beginning of the Messiah's ministry. However, nothing of significance happened in 388 BCE, which leads us to believe that the sevens or weeks are prophetic time based on the year-day principle. When the spies went into Canaan for 40 days to spy out the land and brought an evil report back to Moses that discouraged the people were sentenced to wander for 40 years in the wilderness, a year for each day. If we use that same principle for Daniel's timeline, those 69 weeks, or 483 days, become 483 years. This takes us to 27 CE. Remember, there is no zero year. This coincides with John the Baptist's proclamation of Jesus as a Messiah. However, the 70th week seals the deal, for the prophecy says that in the middle of that week, the Messiah would be put to death. Jesus' ministry lasted 3.5 years. He died on the cross in the middle of that prophetic week. That final prophetic week was completed with the stoning of Stephen and the beginning of the work for the Gentiles. Driven from Jerusalem, Christians sought refuge from persecution by the Jews and carried the Jesus narrative with them, evangelizing the Roman Empire in the process. John the Baptist and Jesus both attempted to reach the descendants of those who rebuilt Jerusalem, but they rejected the message, making Jesus the stone the builders rejected. Psalm 118, verse 22. Jesus identified himself as that stone in each of the Synoptic Gospels. After Jesus' ascension, a final warning was given when the Jews began their persecution of Jesus' followers. Their stoning of Stephen signified they would in no way accept Jesus as the cornerstone of their salvation. But with the intensifying persecution, fleeing Christians carried their nascent faith like dandelion seeds on the wind, taking root everywhere. To further accentuate the point, Saul, who became Paul, a leader in persecuting the Christians, and who acquiesced in the murder of Stephen, converted to Christ to become the most prolific missionary of the early church, both in terms of converts and in the body of writing he left. Pauline theology has shaped the church and its personality to the present. His epistle to the Romans even sparked the fires of Reformation in the heart of a medieval monk, Martin Luther. Daniel prophesied that one day a stone cut out without hands would replace the kingdoms of this earth with the kingdom of God. That stone is Jesus, rejected by the builders, but nonetheless defeating the kingdoms of this world. That stone has grown to fill the entire earth. Many have continued to reject the stone. Competing religions have attempted to displace the stone, but still it endures and perseveres. The Bible, containing the gospel according to Mark, is sold at the rate of more than 6 copies every minute. Mao Zedong's Little Red Book comes in a far distant second. Surprisingly, even the Harry Potter books far outsell the holy writings of the other major faiths, but not the Bible. The Bible has been written off by so many over the centuries but it is a very foundation of Western perspectives on morality. Even the uneducated, the illiterate, who have never cracked open the pages of the Bible, know that somewhere in its pages it says, "Thou shalt not kill." Its influence is pervasive. Even the atheist must deal with the influence of the Bible, despite their denial of the God presented in its pages. Despite attempts to relegate it to obscurity and Christianity extinct, it endures like an anvil that bears the blows of many a smith, but continues to shape the metal put upon it. Hammer blow after hammer blow, raining down, reveals a new creation shaped both by the steadfast anvil and the hammer blows that form a new creation in the process. While it is possible to never appreciate or accept the Bible, our world continues to be shaped by its influence on the lives of those who read its pages and are changed by what they read. We may reject Jesus and the Bible that tells us of him, but still we are told that kingdom will fill the earth. We can reject it like the Jews who rejected Jesus as the cornerstone of their faith, or we can embrace it like Paul. We are free to choose. Love allows us that. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find the written version of this commentary at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. You can also find hundreds more commentaries, podcasts, articles, and links to books by the author at that website. Once again, it's www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.